You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire, 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
You are indeed tuned into The Wire. Kia ora, welcome to The Wire for Monday the 19th of June. Ko Amanda Jane Robinson, toku ingoa. My name is Amanda Jane Robinson. Today's show was produced by Ben Goldson. On the show today, we'll have Green Party co-leader James Shaw talking about Labour's immigration policy and where the Greens sit on the political spectrum. Are they moving more towards the centre? We'll see what James Shaw has to say about that. We'll also have AET Pacific Media Centre's Kendall Hutt live for all the latest in Pacific news for Southern Cross. We'll be talking about the Grenfell Tower fire in London. So we'll be looking into what happened there and what the risk is of that. Something like that happening here in Aotearoa. We'll also talk to the president of the Psychological Society, Quentin Abram, about the UNICEF Innocent Eye report into child wellbeing. Remember, if you have anything you'd like to add throughout the show, give us a text on 5395, or you can even give us a call on 309 3879. Later in the show, also Ben Goldson speaks with Etu's Assistant National Secretary John Ryle about pay equity for workers in the mental health sector. But first up, Ben spoke to the President of the Psychological Society, Quentin Abram, about the UNICEF Innocent Eye report into child wellbeing.
In a UNICEF study which ranked 41 countries according to childhood wellbeing, New Zealand placed 34th. The Innocent Eye report card judges countries on several factors to create a well-rounded assessment of standards of living for children around the world. Although New Zealand did relatively well in categories such as sustainable cities, our worst result was in good health and well-being, with only three countries judged to be worse. In response to the report, the New Zealand Psychological Society issued a press release calling for the government to do more about child poverty. I speak to the president of the society, Quentin Abraham, and asked him what the report card said about being a child in New Zealand.
Unfortunately, it's not a very good picture for our children in Aotearoa, New Zealand. Out of 41 high-income countries, we rank 34th in terms of well-being. And these are on the sort of internationally agreed sustainable development goals, and 38 for the highest rate of suicide for 15 to 19 year olds. Many children, despite early difficulties, will develop resilience, will go on to live full and active lives, but from the, you know, our members from the New Zealand Psychological Society do not want to see young people have to struggle that hard to overcome these difficulties. So yes, it's likely to cause difficulties later on.
And what would you like to see from government and civil society in response to these findings?
I mean, this report is an independent report. It's carried out on all those high-income countries around the world. It is not good for us to be lumped in with low-income countries such as Lithuania and Bulgaria and the like, or to be lumped in with countries such as America, which is a high-income country but is not doing well by poverty. So I'd be saying to the government, look at the policies that we have. Let's emulate countries such as Finland, Norway, where they've managed to reduce child poverty by two-thirds, and wonder what that would mean if we could actually create a situation where our young people were not in poverty and were much less likely to have mental health problems. Sadly, this has not come as a surprise to us. The New Zealand Psychological Society has offered a report on poverty and mental health. It's a devastating impact on in terms of what happens to young people in later life if they have experienced poverty in early life. It's going to have a much greater impact on their well-being in later life. The New Zealand Psychological Society has recently released a report on the links between poverty and mental health. And if we were able to reduce poverty, up to about a third of mental health difficulties in young people in later life would not be present, and we would like to see as much effort put into prevention as well as actually providing the sort of care and treatment of those who experience mental health difficulties.
Of brown paper, sounds that we bring are of a different nature. Rhythms get greater, and the rhythms they get greater. Yes, another effort to form for the chaser. New configuration, new riff, and new structure. Built on the frame that'll hold and won't puncture. Tight, we wrap it up, it's wrapped tightly.
To hear from the Green Party with co-leader James Shaw.
Hi James, are you there?
I am.
How are you going this week?
Yeah, very good, thank you. It's a gorgeous sunny day where I am, so
I'm
enjoying that.
Whereabouts are you? It's a bit cloudy up here.
I am in Wellington because it's a sitting week, so Parliament is back on deck tomorrow.
Oh, very good. All right, I guess the first thing we want to talk about today is Labor's immigration policy. So the Labor Party announced that this past week it would make it tougher for low-skilled workers and students in low-level education courses to come to New Zealand as part of its plan to reduce new immigrant numbers. What do you make of this?
Well, I mean, I think the first, before we get into the specifics of Labor's plan, I think the first thing that we really need to maintain our focus on is the kind of, you know, the principles of being humane in our immigration policy, because I think that often gets lost in the debate, and I think it's a sort of a sign of how the conversation around immigration has been captured by people with a, you know, sort of a xenophobic or even a racist agenda over the past couple of decades. It makes it very difficult to have a kind of a rational conversation about it. So you know, so I think it's really important that we treat people, you know, well, and that we focus on the experience that, you know, new Zealanders have when they're coming over here, rather than just to kind of treat them as, you know, economic units that are there for our benefit. So having said all of that, I know, you know, I think that Labor have actually done their homework. I know they ran into a bit of trouble last year, but they've actually gone away and done some work on it. And I think it's a you know, an open secret that certainly part of the student visa program is being abused by some really dodgy private training establishments and by the agents that sell these programs overseas. And so I think that those people are getting ripped off, actually, and that we need to make sure that that isn't happening.
Absolutely, but is cutting numbers the answer to that?
Well, I think that certainly you want to kind of crack down on the really dodgy operators. From what I understand, I haven't actually read the full detail of Labor's policy, but from what I understand, what they're trying to do is to crack down on the dodgy operators while still giving people the opportunity to get a world-class New Zealand education at one of our universities or, one of the polytechs or something like that.
Right, this is $30,000 a year, though, so that can't all be from those dodgy operations. Is this the Green Party's immigration policy also?
No, it's not. Okay. Actually, we're actually currently in the middle of reviewing our immigration policy, and that'll be out, I think, sometime at the end of this month or the beginning of next month.
And so what do you make of claims by ACT United Future that this is kind of cynical xenophobia?
Well, again, I think that actually Labor's heart is in the right place. From what I've heard of them talking about it recently, I heard Jacinda Ardern give a speech where she talked about the old Norman Kirk quote. At the end of the day, all people really want is someone to love, somewhere to live, somewhere to work, and hope for the future. And actually, the Labor Party. My sense is that the Labor Party are trying to make sure that people who come to this country have access to those things, my sense is that's where they're coming from. I do know that there was kind of trouble last year with the Chinese sounding surnames and all of that kind of piece, and so there's a bit of a kind of a legacy to overcome.
And just lastly on this topic, you said obviously, we don't want to be treating immigration as something just for economic growth. But Bill English has said that reducing these numbers of immigrants coming in will drastically kind of stall economic growth because of those people in working positions. What is your kind of response to that?
Well, I think that this is part of the problem, right? Is actually that the way that the immigration system is working at the moment is actually highly exploitative of those people who are coming here. These are the people who are, really struggling to find houses. They're really struggling to find jobs where they're getting paid even above the minimum wage. There's a real sense of we're hearing some kind of terrible stories about the treatment that these people are getting. And so that's kind of what I mean, right, is that we say, well, if the only reason we want people to come to this country is so that we can get richer somehow, then that is actually not the right kind of ethical framework, I think, for an immigration policy, that it should be focused on, being able to have, people who can come over here on humanitarian grounds because they want somewhere to live, a better place to live and hope for the future, and good jobs and so on. And I think actually we need to do a better job of that than we are at the moment.
All right, and moving on to the other topic we're going to talk about today. Now, a Bryce Edwards blog and in the wider kind of talk about this, there's been talk about the Green Party evolving in a more moderate direction, shifting towards the middle of the political spectrum, becoming increasingly pragmatic. Do you agree?
Well, I think two things has happened, and pundits have got all sorts of things to say. Some of them say we're too left-wing, some of them say we're too right-wing, all that kind of stuff. I don't pay a lot of attention to that, but I think two things has happened, one of which is that we are expanding in terms of our popularity and the range of people that we, that support us, and outside of our traditional base. But that isn't to say that we're moving away from our historic base, right? So it's more like an expansion rather than a movement. And the other thing that's happened is that the things that we have been talking about in Parliament for the last 20 years have now become very mainstream, right? So, we've been leading on climate change, we've been leading on housing, we've been leading on the need to lift people out of poverty, we've been leading on cleaning up our rivers. And all of these things actually are now concerns that, pretty much everyone buys into. And the only real argument we're having is about how to get there. And so I think that, as that happens, the things that we talk about appear to be more mainstream. Or people may say we're becoming more mainstream, but I would actually say that the mainstream is moving towards, us.
So if we're looking at this kind of not in opposition to what's mainstream, but opposition to National in that you are an opposition party, how do you kind of reconcile the things like, for example, voting for the Working for Families and income tax thresholds that are more centrist in the policy?
Well, actually, I would argue they're not, right? So in, that is a sign of how we have been able to shift the mainstream towards us, that you have a national government that was prepared to increase benefits to low-income families, including some of New Zealand's most excluded people. And that is quite a shift for them. They've moved. And we have won the argument that the way that we have in this country, the way that New Zealand has been treating the unemployed, kind of very limited means, has been extremely punitive, and we need to do better. And if we actually want to lift people out of poverty in this country, then we've got to give it some priority, some focus. My problem with the national budget, the family support package, is that it simply didn't go far enough.
Yeah, I mean, that offered low-income people more money, but not a whole lot. So I guess, do you think that the Green Party should be more offering an alternative, or just kind of falling in line if National does compromise a little?
Well, we will be offering an alternative. That's what the election is all about. So we will be saying exactly what it is that we will do when we are in government to lift low-income families out of poverty and into greater opportunity.
Awesome. Thank you so much. We'll talk to you again in a couple of weeks.
Good to talk to you. Thanks for having me.
Bye.
That was James Shaw for the Green Party. The Wire.
After the break, we'll have AUT Pacific Media Centre's Kendall Hutt with all the latest in Pacific news for the Southern Cross.
Cor blimey, Gov. Only gone and non-stop me Jamie Oliver in it, my son.
Oh my God. Are you okay?
Obviously. I'm just practising my London grammar for the gig.
Award-nominated London Grammar are finally heading to New Zealand to mark the release of their critically acclaimed second album, Truth is a Beautiful Thing. London Grammar, playing Auckland's Spark Arena Saturday, September 30th. Tickets on sale now from Ticketmaster.
95BFM and NZ On Air Music presents Out on the Freak. Out on the Freak delivers three shows over 3 weeks in three Auckland suburbs. All ages, all free, and broadcast live to BFM's Freak the Sheep. The series kicks off on Wednesday, June 21st with a night of Americana at Devonport's historic Vic Theatre, featuring Bernie Griffin and the Thin Men, Josie Tuck and the Miltones. 95BFM presents Out on the Freak, number one, June 21st at the Vic Theatre Devonport from 7 p.m.
Their relationships with their girlfriends or their wife. No one, they shouldn't have more than one wife at a time.
Now it's time for the Southern Cross with Kendall Hutt.
It is indeed time for the Southern Cross with Kendall Hutt, and we have a couple of special guests in studio today.
I'm joined here today by Stephanie and Kenneth Tapunga from Papua New Guinea. They're studying here in Auckland at the university, and they've come along today to talk a bit about the elections in Papua New Guinea, which polling starts this weekend.
Wonderful. You can just jump straight into that if you like.
So first off, I just wanted to ask you both, what is the general feeling around the elections? Obviously, we're not even a week out anymore and polling starts this weekend. What's the feeling?
I think anticipation, excitement. Everyone is now thinking about who they're going to vote and how they're going to go about it. 8 weeks of campaign, so much has happened during that. We've seen a lot of improvements, a lot of developments compared to the past elections. For example, social media was used mainly by both the intending candidates and supporters and people who either support or not support them and talking about the candidates, talking about their policies and what they are going to do, while other users use it to educate each other and inform each other about the issues that are currently facing the country.
So has the debate online, has that been generally positive, obviously between people and the public of opposing parties?
Yeah, well, there's a mixed sort of feeling at the moment, especially among the people there. Due to the recent changes in the developments, especially with the candidates contesting for the elections, there's been a rise in the women numbers, contestants, and this is, in a way, also with the influx of the social media, has really changed the dynamic of the game itself, and this has really challenged the existing status quo of elections and campaigns. So much has happened, and I think one of the main things that have been aired over from the recent times now is that people are really trying to get rid of the issues of concern like corruption and transparency and all this. So there is this push for towards a more transparent sort of an election, and candidates who vie for standing with policies that, you know, go against corruption are sort of swaying the public opinion to their favour.
And how big of a problem has corruption been in past elections? Have there been any miscounts in the vote, and what kind of problems or issues has that caused?
It was a problem. Many times we have elections where there is issues with the miscounting or dummy or more ballot papers, or people who more count voters from one electorate than they were registered on the common roll. And all those issues where there were massive problems with it, and then we get at the end of the elections we get candidates contest they dispute the results and then take it to the court, and all those has been a big issue in the past, and for this election we don't know how it's going to be, but with the information that is currently flowing in the country, we hope to minimize those they share.
And you've both noted that there's been a rise of female representation in Papua New Guinea. Do you think that will play out in Parliament, and do you think that will be a reality, or is it sort of something that these politicians nod to but don't actually accept?
Female representation in politics in PNG for this year, it's encouraging to see about 165 of them contesting these elections. That's quite a number compared to the past years. And they have support, their support base, and we hope to see them successful. But the thing is, it's a male's politics, it's a male's game as well in PNG. And to get the women there, the last election only 3 got in. So we just have to wait and see and see. But the general feeling about this is men politicians, they support female participation in theory. In practice, that is yet to be seen as a reality.
If I could just add on also, recent pointers have indicated that because of the issues of concern that has formed the basis of arguments for people either going for a candidate or against a candidate. So people seem to be more educated about voting along policy lines. Mm. So if candidates, whether they be male or female, if they are able to portray policies, suggest policies that, you know, deal with real issues at the moment, like corruption and issues of transparency, if either one of these genders, if they stand for this, then they definitely will get votes. Will get votes from people. Well, that is to say, I can make a comment also that literate Papua New Guineans will definitely vote along those lines. But I'm not really sure if the people, the vast majority back in our rural areas, are more attuned in that perspective to also have that vote also in that manner. To support transparency, to support corruption, or they'll be still voting along traditional ties and communal, which has been our past experiences. Yeah.
So, are the candidates making any efforts to engage with the general populace that are not necessarily educated? Is that happening?
Yes, people have gone to the extreme of using the current technologies like the social media, and as well as they have worked, they've taken initiatives in getting transports either by air, through land, and of course over the sea as well. So they have traveled various parts of the hinterlands of the country, and they have tried their best to at least get the message across to the people that this is what I'm standing for and this is what I want to do for you, and all this.
And you both yourselves, you will more than likely be voting in this election period. What are your hopes and sort of dreams for Papua New Guinea moving forward after this election period?
We would definitely want our country to change from the current trend it is going. The trend, current trend indicates a positive sort of approach towards globalization and the modern times now, but that is something that is among the literate population at the moment, and those within the areas of accessibility to infrastructure and development. Those are the things that maybe they form the fundamental things that people would like to see. And our votes would be more, I can only speak for myself. Stephanie will again speak for herself, but yeah, I would like to vote for someone who has a policy that, and of course follows the policy through once that person gets into the position of authority and can exercise aspirations on the policies.
So you'd like to see a party or a candidate stay true to what they've promised in the elections?
Yes. A change would, I think all of us are hoping for a change this election.
Cool. Thank you both.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
That was the Southern Cross.
That was indeed the Southern Cross. For all the latest in Pacific news, you're tuned into The Wire on 95BFM. Remember, if you've got something to say about anything we're talking about today, feel free to text in to 5395. We'd love to hear from you. After the break, we'll be talking about the Grenfell Tower tragedy in London.
You love music, right?
Yes, yes, I do.
Then drive your stake into the musical landscape by voting for the 95BFM Top 10.
But how?
Text the word VOTE and your chosen band's name to 5395, or vote online at 95bfm.com/top10 before 6 p.m. every Wednesday. Then join Pearl from 7 p.m. as she starts counting them down. The 95BFM Top 10 with your host Pearl, Wednesday night 7 till 9, and always online at 95bfm.com.
We'll be right back. Irirangi Poho, Radio Bosom.
The Wire.
At least 58 people are believed to have died early Wednesday morning after a fire blazed through the Grenfell Tower, a 24-storey apartment block in North Kensington, London. Police are expected to announce an increase in the death toll today. The building held 120 apartments with up to 600 residents. 18 people remain in hospital, 9 in critical care, and dozens are still missing. Omar Al-Hajali is the brother of the first named Grenfell Tower victim.
They came for in the last minute. They said when the fire was in the next room, the smoke was coming inside. And they said, come. And they were pushing us. I couldn't see anything. They opened the door, the smoke come inside. I've seen the fire around me. And they were pushing us. I thought they're pushing all of us. I couldn't talk, I couldn't look around. I didn't even see anything. I even my fingers, nothing. I went outside. I called him. He said, where are you? He said, I'm in the... I said, where are you? He said, I'm in the flat. I said, why you didn't come? They brought us outside. I thought you are with us. He said, no one brought me outside.
London Mayor Sadiq Khan has described the fire as a preventable accident caused by years of neglect by local government.
By saying this, anybody who thinks that this community is not a community in the true sense of the word, anybody who thinks it's not possible for Christians, Muslims, Hindus, Sikhs, those members of an organised faith and those others unable to come together, if anybody who thinks it's not possible for people in the deepest and darkest times to show the best of humanity, I say come to North Kensington, come and see not just this congregation but the mosques locally, the other community centres and the other places of worship where you're seeing the best of London and the best of humanity.
Labour MP for Tottenham, David Lammy, spoke to the UK's Channel 4 News about the state of housing in the UK.
This is about the welfare state. For your middle-class viewers, this is about whether the welfare state is just schools and hospitals, or whether it's about having a safety net. I get quite emotional as I say that. We need to live in a society where we care for the poorest and the vulnerable. And that means housing. It means somewhere decent to live. It was a noble idea that we built. And it's falling apart around our eyes. That's what it's about. And if it's taken this tragedy to bring that reality home to people who are lucky enough to live in very different circumstances, then thank God. It's about the welfare state. Do we believe in a safety net or not?
UK Chancellor Philip Hammond says the cladding on the outside of the building, which is thought to have propelled the fire, was banned in Europe and the United States. The Department for Communities and Local Government has said that aluminium cladding with a polyethylene core should not be used on buildings taller than 18 metres. There have been at least 10 other major multi-storey cladding fires worldwide since 2007 with this type of cladding. Initial media reports suggest a lack of sprinklers, inadequate fire detection and alarm systems, and insufficient passive fire stopping also contributed to the spread of the blaze. London Metropolitan Police Commander Stuart Cundy says the fire damage will mean the process of recovery and investigation will take weeks to complete. A group of residents who met with Prime Minister Theresa May have explained the anger of all the residents towards the management of the apartment block over a long period of time, paving the way to this tragedy. We reached out to the Fire Protection Association of New Zealand to ask about the risk of something like this happening here in Aotearoa. They responded with a statement that reads as follows. A similar building in New Zealand would almost certainly be sprinkler protected and most likely also fitted with smoke detectors, evacuation alarm systems, and passive fire stop and smoke stop protection as required by New Zealand Building Code and local standards. Such fire protection systems would also be subject to regular mandatory inspection and testing under the Building Warrant of Fitness System. New Zealand's fire protection codes and regulatory framework are among the most rigorous in the world, refocused in recent years around life safety. Even so, we are continuously looking for ways to improve them. The Fire Protection Association of New Zealand and its members await the outcome of the investigations into this tragedy. We'll ensure that any applicable findings will be used to improve New Zealand's practices even further in the protection of life and property from the impact of fire. Auckland building consultant Louise Swan is calling on the New Zealand government to suspend certification of aluminium composite panels. Ms Swan says she was not questioning the product itself, but that a temporary halt in certification was needed to review information provided on how to install the product in order to resist both water and the spread of the fire. Another type of panel, one that has a mineral core which is much more fire resistant, is more widely used in New Zealand. New Zealand Building and Construction Minister Nick Smith said flammable aluminium cladding had been banned from multi-storey buildings in New Zealand earlier this year, after high-rise fires in Dubai and Melbourne. He had asked the Ministry of Business to contact councils to check whether any high-rise buildings had been constructed with aluminium composite panels. Smith said the fires that took place in Dubai and Melbourne in sprinkler-proofed buildings had made people more aware that fires could start on the outside of buildings. Proposals for tighter safety fire requirements had been put out for consultation in May. The changes would clarify the responsibilities between structural and fire engineers, tighten the verification methods for claddings and firefighting provisions such as water supply and location of fire hydrants in the building, and improve the processes for development of alternative solutions. A criminal investigation into the Grenfell Tower tragedy is looking into manslaughter charges, says Shadow Brexit Secretary and former Director of Public Prosecutions Sir Keir Starmer. He said they'd be looking at whether anyone could be charged with manslaughter following a litany of failings that led to the disaster, in which at least 58 people are now feared to have been killed. Amanda Jane Robinson, BFM News.
Kei te whakarongo koe ki te wire, marunga irirangi pō.
The Wire.
In an agreement reached with the government, care workers will be receiving a pay rise after the 1st of July. However, the Care and Support Worker Pay Equity Settlement does not apply to people in the mental health sector. In protest, unions have lodged a claim on their behalf with the Employment Relations Authority. I spoke with Air2's Assistant National Secretary, John Ryall, and asked him why mental health workers were being left out.
Well, I think it's quite unexplainable why the government has left them out. The unions were keen for them to be included because the work they do was very similar, if not more complex, to what disability support workers do in the community. The government refused to have them included, and so that's why we are filing a separate claim for them. We hope the government will accept that if their work is similar to other care and support workers, we want the same rates of pay, which the other workers are being paid from the 1st of July, and those rates range from $19 an hour up to $23.50.
And what effect will this have on the mental health sector?
Well, it's more what effect it will have if the care and support rates which occur on the 1st of July aren't paid to mental health workers. Because some of these workers work in the same organisations as the care and support workers, so they're getting the pay increase. And so we're concerned that workers will flood out of the mental health side of it into disability, leaving people with mental health issues without support. And we don't think this is acceptable, and we think the authority should agree that these workers should be paid that rate. We're filing the claim with the Employment Relations Authority as a pay equity claim, but obviously the organisations we're filing it against are actually funded by government. And so we do want the government engaged in this process, because finally, they're the ones who will need to pay the bill. Mental health is in the spotlight because it has been underfunded for a number of years. It's under incredible strain. It's been quite difficult for people with mental health issues to get access to services. We're concerned that if, in fact, something isn't done about paying this workforce properly, that the mental health service will get worse.
The Wire.
I don't know, and frankly the whole thing gives me the heebie-jeebies.
The Wire.
Finally on the show today, we speak to Labor's housing spokesperson Phil Twyford about the recent controversy involving the housing affordability measure.
This year saw the unveiling of the housing affordability measure by the Ministry of Business, Employment and Innovation. Based on household income minus the cost of residential property, it found two-thirds of renters and 80% of potential first home buyers were unable to afford the cost of housing. However, concerns have been raised over whether this is too optimistic, with the Reserve Bank criticising the measure's methodology just days before it was released. Although the Reserve Bank is unwilling to discuss their criticisms with the media, others were more forthcoming. Labour Party housing spokesperson Phil Twyford is one. I asked him for his evaluation of the housing affordability measure.
Yeah, this is a good idea, you know, housing affordability measure. I think everybody agrees that the housing crisis is probably the biggest challenge the country faces at the moment. It's perhaps only the national government who deny that we've got a crisis, but everybody else, I think, knows that's the case. And having good data upon which to base policy has got to be a big help. And so we welcome the idea of this measure, but really its implementation has been a fiasco. And the latest chapter has been this revelation that 2 days before Nick Smith, the minister, released the housing affordability measure, the Reserve Bank advised MB that they'd used the wrong interest rate. And inexplicably, Nick Smith went ahead knowing that the measure was based on the wrong interest rate, mortgage interest rate, went ahead and released the measure anyway. And I kind of think that shows how desperate the government is to try to make out that housing is more affordable than it really is. Because what the Reserve Bank advised was that the interest rate that MB had used for the measure was a thing called the effective rate, which is kind of a composite of all the different interest rates that are out there in the market. What they should have used, really, for it to make any sense, was the actual interest rate that, say, a first-home buyer would pay taking on a mortgage for a new home. And, in fact, the interest rate that they used in the measure is traditionally, on average, a full percentage point less than the interest rate that you'd pay out in the market taking on a new mortgage. So, and that would make a difference. Say you've got a $500,000 mortgage over 25 years, that would make a difference of about $3,500 a year in payments to the bank. So the measure artificially, this error, which was deliberately released by the minister, had the effect of making housing look like it was more affordable than it really is. So it's kind of a fiasco. It took 5 years of work by officials. That's a lot of work. It first came to light, actually, when an Official Information Act release showed officials in writing expressing concern that ministers may find the contents of the measure politically embarrassing. Well, that was prescient because that's actually what has proved to be the case. Critics have pointed out that the measure is based on data that's 2 years old. So that's kind of another thing that sort of, I think, undermines the credibility of the measure. And the other thing about it is that the methodology puts a lot of weight on interest rates and the serviceability of a mortgage. Now, we're in a period at the moment of relatively low interest rates historically, but there's no certainty that will continue. The other big element of affordability for home ownership, of course, is whether you can save up the deposit to buy a house in the first place. And when you see that house prices in Auckland, for instance, have doubled since National's been in office, and the average house price in Auckland is now $1 million, actually, that is a really important part of affordability. So that's a question mark hanging over the measure. And I think that's compounded and made significantly worse, really, by the fact that they've used an interest rate that makes housing look more affordable than it is. So it's kind of been a chapter of errors. What should have been, I think, a really good and useful exercise to better inform the public debate on housing affordability has proved to be an own goal for the government.
That was The Wire.
That was indeed The Wire for Monday the 19th of June 2017. Thanks to everyone who came on the show today. Today's show was produced by Ben Goldson, and a big thank you to News Director Ximena Smith also. Rachel is up next with your 1 to 4. I'm Amanda Jane Robinson. Have a lovely afternoon.
That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95BFM.com/bcasts.